What's up? So, just a bit of an intro to this interview with Kent Graziano, who, in my opinion, is one of the OGs of the data field. And I guess it's the old saying that you have the interview that you want to have, and there's the interview that you get. And this is definitely the interview that I got. I thought we'd be talking about his time at Snowflake, and a lot of things that he's pretty famous for, writing books and all this stuff. We certainly get into it, but I was actually so fascinated by his early career and a lot of the work that he did there that we just kind of went with that instead. And I think this might be one of the first times Kent's discussed, in one sitting his early career, which I think you'll find quite interesting. So Kent is, I consider him definitely an innovator, an accidental innovator, probably in some ways. I mean, as you listen, I noticed that he probably accidentally started doing data ops before that was even a thing. So he'll learn a lot about that. So I jokingly call him the data ops warrior. He called himself the data warrior. But either case, yeah, very fascinating interview. Definitely one of the interviews that I appreciate, just because the thing I like about the podcast I do and the interviews that I have is sometimes they take a very predictable direction, and other times they end up like this. And this is exactly the type of interview that I am going after and that I cherish a lot. So I hope you enjoy it. What's up, Ken? How you doing?
Good. How are you today, Joe?
Good, good, good. Just wrapping up a day of calls and really fun stuff. So yeah, it's good to talk to you though. So it's the highlight of my day. So
Good, good.
it's awesome. So yeah, we caught up a couple months ago and no, a few months ago now over in Austin for Data
Yeah, that was
Texas.
January. Yeah, it's almost the end of March here, and I think that it was 2 months ago now.
That's crazy. So time flies. Felt like yesterday. So I think we're having a barbecue at a really good barbecue joint on 6th Street or
Yeah,
something. So
Cooper's Barbecue there in downtown Austin. Yeah,
good place.
Alpha. Yes, definitely.
Yes, that's awesome. Yeah, but then I think we started talking, and I was like, then we I realized you had a whole another side to you that we can talk about. We'll get into. But yeah, I guess for the audience who don't know who you are, do you want to give a quick intro?
Sure. So Kent Graziano. My moniker is the Data Warrior. I have been in the IT world for my entire adult life, since actually my senior year in high school. And that's, I'm in the multiples of decades now, and to the point that I'm semi-retired. So it's been a while. I've seen a massive change and evolution in the space. Started off as a programmer and eventually got into databases with DBase2. Was the first database that
Around
I
what year
worked.
was that?
That, whoa, geez, DBase2 was 1984, I think. 84 or 85, right after I got out of university. I was working for US Geological Survey, and got into doing some programming, working with them at the Denver Federal Center, and got introduced to this DBase2, was what we were used on this massive 10 meg hard drive, external hard
Whoa.
drive, Winchester hard drive. Never forget that.
Wait, Winchester was the name of it or the
Was the
brand?
Winchester was the brand, it was the company that made the hard drive, was
It
the
wasn't the
name.
same one that makes rifles, is it?
I don't think so. I think that was their branding on it. I don't remember who the actual hardware maker was, but I remember it was a Winchester hard drive. It was an external hard drive that we had to plug into our desktop PCs, and we had very, very early versions of desktop PCs at the time. So I got into that. Eventually, not too long after that, a year or so after that, got introduced to Oracle with version 5.1 of Oracle, which was the first version of Oracle that ran on a PC that didn't have to be on a DEC or a VAX or some other mainframe type server. It actually ran on a desktop. So I got started in the Oracle world there. Eventually gravitated mid 90s, got introduced to data warehousing and went, okay, this is it. you know, after the programming and doing database development, some OLTP sorts of things, and becoming a data modeler in that space. And I got introduced to data warehousing and got to meet and co-author a book with Bill Inman, got to meet Claudia Imhoff. Wow. I was in Denver at the time, and that was like the epicenter of data warehousing, with Claudia and the Boulder BI Brain Trust, and Bill lived just south of Denver. Bill Inman lived south of Denver, and it was, you know, a great time to get introduced to data warehousing with, you know, all the brightest minds of data warehousing, and the thought leaders were all within driving distance of me. So that got me going into all of that, and pretty much stayed in the Oracle space for, you know, gosh, almost seems like it was pretty close to 30 years until I got introduced to Snowflake. I did a little bit of SQL Server, but, you know, once I switched into data warehousing, it was all analytics, reporting, data warehousing design, you know, and as you know, eventually got introduced to the Data Vault methodology, because Dan was in Denver when he invented Data Vault. That's where he lived at the time.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. His office was, this is when I went to work for Denver Public Schools, and his office was like three blocks from my office. And so I got to go over and do some lunch and learn seminars when he was first introducing Data Vault. And, you know, we became friends, and I managed to convince the district to let me build their first ever data warehouse using a Data Vault approach, and hired Dan as an advisor to come in and work with my team. That's how I got into Data Vault. That's how I ended up helping him write the first book, because we did a pretty good, pretty big Oracle data warehouse system with a persistent staging area, with Data Vault, with dimensional models on the other side for reporting, all on the web. Actually, it was all delivered via web server and web apps. And then even took some of that and extracted into some advanced analytical applications for doing projections on a innovative pay for performance system that we designed for the school district. And so Dan was part of that. And through all that, we ran into a couple of bumps of things that Dan hadn't seen, and were able to figure out how to do that in the Data Vault method. And that led to me co-authoring the first two books on Data Vault with him. So I got to start off in the mid-90s co-authoring a book with Bill Inman, and then in the early 2000s got to do the Data Vault stuff with Dan. Eventually moved here to Texas, where I live now, worked for HP on their big enterprise data warehouse system on a new piece of hardware they invented called NeoView. That was HP's attempt to build an MPP to compete with Teradata. And at the time, Mark Hurd, who had been the president of NCR Teradata, was the CEO of HP. And Randy Mott, who had been the, I think, CIO at Walmart when they did all of that stuff with Teradata, he was the CIO of HP at the time. And so they tried to engineer an MPP system, and we built a massive enterprise data warehouse for HP with their data internally. And that's what got me to Houston, is I actually came to, I got recruited to come work on that. So I did a couple of years out of the Oracle world working on NeoView and learning about MPP architectures, which turns out was very useful when I eventually ended up at Snowflake and having to understand, you know, parallel processing and all the, you know, compute in the cloud and separation compute from storage that Snowflake innovated on. So I went from, you know, the SMP to MPP, and eventually over to, I don't know what we call that, separation of compute from storage at Snowflake, cloud world. So he said it's seen a lot of changes over the last couple of decades in how we do things, the methodologies, as well as the hardware and infrastructure that we use to do it all.
Walk me through this. I've always been curious about this. I traveled to Denver quite a bit to go see friends, including Bill. Spent a lot of time at his house. And I've always wondered, it felt like Denver, for whatever reason, had a very strong concentration of data people. Like you mentioned Bill, Claudia, Dave McComb also there. Really good at what he does. And then I had no idea Dan was there. What, like, and you're there? I thought you were in Denver for when I met you, and
So I lived in Denver from, you know, I went to University of Denver, so I emigrated from upstate New York the snow belt up north of Syracuse off of Lake Ontario to Denver to go to University of Denver, and went to school there and landed the job with the U.S. Geological Survey after my sophomore year. I started working there on a summer gig that turned into, you know, a part-time job for a number of years. And then ended up doing the Oracle work at the Denver Federal Center for some other agencies. That's where I learned it. And then along the lines, I ended up meeting Dan and Bill and, you know, Len Silverston. I worked for Len.
Oh, yeah. He was there too.
Yeah. So I worked for Len. We were at the Data Model Resource book with Bill. That was the book we co-authored with Bill Inman, was the first edition of the Data Model Resource book.
Great book, by the way.
Yeah. And that's where I really got to dig into the the data warehousing aspects and the whole ecosystem of going from, you know, enterprise OLTP systems to enterprise data warehousing, a la Bill's original methodology, with then dimensional models on the other side for reporting. So I'd always been working in this three-tier architecture, and that was basically under Bill's guidance, right? Which that eventually turned into the corporate information factory that he and Claudia wrote about, right? And that became very popular. So that's how I got my indoctrination, I'll say, into data warehousing. And that was, you know, 5 years, I think, before I met Dan.
That's crazy.
Before Data Vault came out.
What was it about the environment in Denver that there were so many strong data people? I mean, this was, as you say, the epicenter. I had no idea it was this strong, though.
Well, and that's why Claudia's group, the Boulder BI Brain Trust, is based in Boulder, Colorado, because there were all these other people around. You know, Sean Rogers was there. There's, I'm forgetting so many names of all the people that were in the Denver area. I don't know what it was. I honestly have no idea how that happened, but it turned out it was like, this is the epicenter of BI and data warehousing.
Yeah.
For whatever reason, there was a huge, a lot of it was in Oracle too. It was a huge Oracle community. The Rocky Mountain Oracle user group was at that time and for decades really was the largest independent Oracle user group in the United States. It was bigger than New York City. It was bigger than Los Angeles. You know, it was the largest and most active user group in the country. And a lot of this work was done through that. I mean, I made a lot of my contacts, through that user group and being on their board of directors, helping with their annual training days. Nobody was ever able to explain that either. We always like, scratching our heads. It's like, what's with all the data here? But then you also had Sun. Right. Sun was off the turnpike, where they, they started with the, the, Java and all of that was invented there. There was a big disk drive company there too, that Sun bought, and then Oracle eventually bought all of it. So there was some hardware vendors in the area, and, a fair amount of software, but a lot of, the telephone companies. I did a lot of work with US West, which became Quest, which was basically the telco for the Western United States. Coors Brewery, huge. They were one of the early users of SAP, and they did SAP on Oracle. So I interviewed for a job there at one point, and that's when I just found out about the, that all the tables in the SAP schema were in German. Right. And they were abbreviated because at the time we were still basically on DOS, a lot of eight character table names. Right. But they were German abbreviations. And Coors Brewery was one of the first to do that. And they were a huge user of SAP as well as Oracle. And it was SAP on Oracle. So it was probably one of the bigger early implementations of SAP on Oracle. Yeah. All that stuff happened there. All that stuff was in Denver. Just because people love Colorado, right? It's a beautiful place to live, and they had the Denver Tech Center. And so there was a lot of effort put in there, to have this technology center. It was crazy. It was just good fortune for me that, where I decided to go to school. And I went to school, by the way. I got my degrees in environmental science. Yeah, no way. I never took a computer science class in my life.
How the hell did you end up in this industry then?
Yeah, go figure. I learned to program my senior year in high school with my calculus teacher. He convinced the school board to let him buy a computer so he could try to automate, of all things, the daily attendance by getting a card reader, an OCR scanner basically, that would scan, you know, the teachers check off who was missing, threw it to his office. We scanned it. He wrote a little basic program that looped through it and read it, and, you know, and in 10 minutes spit out an absentee list that they could send to the head office. And then we just went from there and, you know, learned how to program basic using as we called it, a Trash 80, TRS-80, one of the original Radio Shack computers, the storage media for, you know, people. You won't even know what this is. It was on a cassette tape. And a lot of your listeners are probably going to go, what the heck's a cassette tape? Right. So we're talking, you know, pre-DVD, pre-VCRs, pre-everything. There were no hard disks. There were no floppy drives. We were using literally music cassette tapes to store the data. So that's what got me into it. And then I had a work study job at the university working in a lab. And I literally observed, and, you know, this kind of will lead up to where I got to, right, is I observed things, and I noticed the PhD student who's sitting there with a TI calculator and his research book, and he's keying in numbers over and over again and then writing something down in his book. And I finally asked him what he was doing. It's like he was having to do all these calculations from his experiments, and he was doing them by hand with a calculator. And I said, hey, you know, teach me the formula. Teach me what you're doing. Teach me what the variables are, what could change. And I wrote him a basic program on the mainframe and said, okay, just sit down here at the teletype, you know, put in your numbers there and hit a button. And it, you know, eventually print out all of his calculations for him, so he didn't have to go through and do the math. I figured out how to do that and for him, and that just led me down the road of doing kind of programming as a hobby, though I was actually getting paid for it as a work study student. If I remember correctly, it was like $5 an hour. That was one of the highest paid work study students.
That's actually pretty good back then.
No, the professor liked me, and so he bumped it up as high as they would let him pay any student. And that just, I had that skill. So when I got to the U.S. Geological Survey and I was doing some actual mapping and some research and stuff for them, at one point I didn't have anything to do. And I said, hey, you know, I think that guy over there, is he's like your computer guy? And like, yeah. I said, does he need any help? I said, let's go ask him. And he's like, yeah, absolutely, I can use some help. And so he took me under his wing, taught me Fortran, and eventually taught me DBase 2. And, you know, the rest, as they say, is history. And so, you know, I got with my degree in environmental science and got hired on there to USGS to do, it was basically environmental programming. We were doing water resources. Wow. We were doing groundwater flow studies, built some early GIS things on a mainframe, pulling data out of something using SAS from way back then. And IBM JCL, job control language, to pull the data out of this big mainframe in Reston, Virginia, to where we were in Denver, and then taking that data and creating a data file and feeding it into a Fortran program we wrote that called, we had it was a library of subroutines, you might remember those, library of subroutines they were mapping subroutines. And so we were actually plotting contour maps of water quality, total dissolved solids, and pH and things like that on the big, massive printers. And so we were doing what eventually became GIS back in, this was 1982.
Whoa.
Probably 82 or 83.
For the audience too, the printers back then were dot matrix printers, right?
Yes. Yeah. And the printer was like, you know, the size of a very large table. And it took forever for it to print out. And we had to manually, you know, download the data, put it on a very large floppy drive at the time from the mainframe and then put that into another computer to transfer the data. It was before FTP or anything off. It was truly sneakernet, right? We downloaded data onto off of one machine and walked it over and plugged it into another machine and uploaded it. And so I got to do all kinds of fun stuff. I got to see, work with some data from one of the very first Landsat satellites that went up, because USGS managed that as well. And some of the studies we were doing required data from that. So I learned, I did basically on the job training, learning other programming languages, and eventually self-taught myself Oracle and SQL and, you know, the various tools that Oracle had, and over the years did all of that. And, you know, like I said, eventually ended up getting introduced to data warehousing. And at that point, I could see, and this was probably, this was mid-90s, and I could see that in my mind, you know, the web was just starting to be a thing. But I could see every business, we talked about it as business intelligence, decision support system, expert systems, back then. And I was like, every business is going to need this. If they've got data, they could be successful. Where my, what I had been doing is building, you know, basically bespoke operational systems for different organizations that I'd worked for and as a consultant. And it's like, eventually things like Oracle, it was called Oracle Financials at the time. Now I think it's Oracle E-Business Suite, you know, and PeopleSoft was coming up, and I could see, you know, some of the back office sort of stuff that's eventually going to become commoditized. And now we call them SaaS applications, right? It's like, so eventually the work to be building bespoke systems like that is going to get less and less and less. But I could see, you know, from the data perspective, the data was going to get bigger and it was going to get more important, and it would be important to every business, this whole idea of business intelligence, that I could see no matter what industry you were in, that you could do better running your business if you could analyze this data. And so I dove in really, you know, kind of head first. And again, like I said, I was very lucky that I was in Denver and got to be mentored by the likes of Bill Inman and Claudia Imhoff, and you know, went from there and eventually ended up getting the opportunity to join Snowflake when it came around.
That's interesting too. I think that when we're hanging out, what I realized is I didn't know your past, you know, and I thought it was interesting that it wasn't a linear, predictable path to to anything, frankly. You were doing the work. I think we're riffing on the Denver public school systems for a while too. And
I did five years there. They actually hired me when I was a consultant, and I think somebody heard me speak probably at a Rocky Mountain Oracle user group meeting, did a presentation on data warehousing or something. And they sought me out, and they needed to build basically an all-inclusive report for the principals, where they could do a student activity report and, like, basically look at all the information about any particular student, their grades, their attendance, any disciplinary actions, their test scores, all of that. And they wanted it in one report, right? And this is like basically every bit of information about a student, but they could do that from their student information system. And it didn't have very much information on the teachers either, other than, you know, the class and the teacher's name. So they wanted to build something, and they came to the conclusion they wanted to build an operational data store. So they actually hired me, and I used the Oracle Designer tool and built them a semantic business-based operational data store. You know, abstracted it from the operational systems they were using and did a third normal form, you know, very normalized thing. And then we generated all that. We generated all the code using Oracle Designer, and then including the reports, and, you know, got them one big massive report that, you know, you could give the principals access to. They could log in, and it restricted them to just the students in their school. So it filtered by the school. So you get the principal name and the school, and that was the security table. And they could go in and look at the information. And then after that, they came to the conclusion that really they probably needed to have a data warehouse because they didn't actually have a data warehouse. This was just kind of the beginnings of it. And so they opened a position for a manager for, they called it the Enterprise Data Integration Team, and recruited me to go in there. I, you know, interviewed for the position, got it. And then over time, built up a team. Nobody there had any experience in data warehousing. So I, you know, trained them. I was the lead architect and data modeler because there weren't any data modelers, though they had some programmers and some people who knew some Oracle DBAs. And then in the process of that, in my research, I had already tripped across one of Dan's papers about Data Vault. And he started to do these lunch and learns about, you know, what is Data Vault and what's the benefit of it. And since it was right near the office, I went over and sat through a couple of those, had a bunch of heated conversations with him about the pros and cons, because I'd done Kimball and Inman both for a number of years. And he convinced me. I looked at it, it's like, you know, this every problem he listed that he said Data Vault solves these problems, I could verify that they were indeed problems because I had run into all of those problems in my other gigs. And so the school district said, basically, you know, there was no fight over should we use Data Vault or dimensional models. They said, hey, we hired you because we don't know what we're doing. So if you want to do this Data Vault thing, go for it as long as it works when you're done. Right. And so we took the whole team to training with Dan, our project manager, our business analyst, the ETL developers, the DBAs. We all went and went through one of the very first Data Vault classes with Dan right down the street from us, and then had him come in every other week and QA what we were doing and make sure we weren't doing anything stupid, that we were building the hubs and links and satellites correctly, applying all of his techniques. And that was a great success. It was there, like I said, for 5 years. So built it on it was before Oracle Exadata even existed, built it on a big HP box. Used all Oracle tools, and we went to Oracle Open World and got invited to go give talks because we had a full end-to-end Oracle system, including using their web servers and their reporting tools and all sorts of fun stuff. So, and that was something at that point in my career, I had realized I had been a consultant for quite a number of years at that point. And I realized I'd never actually seen a project all the way through to the end, because you know what it's like with a consultant. You go in, they got a problem, you go in and help them solve the problem.
Yeah.
You probably weren't there when they greenfield it and they spec'd it. And you didn't get to be there when it got rolled out in most cases. So I figured, you know, this was an opportunity to build something completely from the ground up where there was, you know, total greenfield, and craft an entire architecture and a solution, you know, all the way up to training the end users. So I figured that would be a good experience for me. And it was, you know, I got to learn to, you know, how to build a team. And that's when I started applying Agile, as I got introduced to Agile. The CIO had us read a book on Agile project management. And he said, you know, I don't want you to necessarily do Scrum or XP or any of these other very specific things that they use in software. But he said, you know, maybe there's something there you can learn and apply. And that's what got me down the Agile data warehousing path and thinking about is how do we apply Agile in the data world?
Right. That's interesting, sort of the application, though, of software principles to data, because I think the Agile Data Warehouse might have been one of the first efforts of that. Walk me through that, because I've always been curious about the sort of the intersection of software practices and data.
So, you know, the Agile Manifesto is really the Agile Software Manifesto and the 12 principles of Agile. It was all around, you know, delivering. I mean, the goal, as is stated in the manifesto, is the ideal was to deliver working software. Okay, so that became a challenge. The first time I suggested on some mail list that I wanted to apply Agile principles to data warehousing, people said I was, they didn't even say I was nuts. They just said, well, you can't do that because Agile is about delivering working software. And in a data warehouse, there's no working software. And it's like, what? What do you say? Excuse me? It's like, you know, if I talk to my ETL developer and tell him that all that ETL code he's writing isn't software and it doesn't work, that, you know, he's going to be kind of disappointed, to say the least. So I spent a lot of time studying the Agile principles and saying, you know, let's think about this from a data perspective. How does this principle apply? And developed a talk around that that I've given for now like the last 15 years on and off about how to apply Agile principles. But that eventually, as you may have gathered, you know, Agile led to DevOps. Agile data warehousing has led to data ops, right? Mm-hmm. That, you know, the ideas are there, trying to do the iterations, trying to be focused on the business, you know, the idea of a product owner before we ever talked about data products. It's like we're talking about having a product owner who helps you develop a prioritized backlog. What features do you really need? Okay, well, in the data world is, okay, what data do you really need? And how, why do you need it? You know, what business problem are you trying to solve with this data? And, it, you know, do you need a pie chart? Do you need a spreadsheet? You know, do you need a tabular report? And what data really needs to be on it to solve the problem? Well, this whole, it just give me all the data. No, I'm not going to give you all the data, right? It's going to, you got 15 source systems and thousands of fields and you want it yesterday. Well, let's be realistic. That's not going to happen. So tell me, what could we give you in, say, a month that you would find very helpful? You know, let's get it down to the minimum viable product, as they call it in Agile, right? Let's get it down to something that will be helpful in the short term that helps us, though, build towards a long-term architecture. And so, again, it was applying the principles, though not necessarily the techniques. Because one of the things in Agile is having a, a team whose members are basically swappable, right? And the idea of this cross-functional team that people on the team decide what problem they're going to solve today. It's like, well, that works great if you got a team of 10 Java developers.
Right.
Because any one of them could solve the problems. But when you're talking about data, it's like, you know, ETL developers don't necessarily know how to do data modeling. Data modelers don't necessarily how to do DBA work. And so it's a different kind of team. So you did need kind of a technical lead, and we had some new roles. Ralph Hughes wrote about this in his book, Agile Data Warehousing. I kind of tripped over and discovered the same things in my work at Denver Public Schools. And oddly enough, Ralph Hughes was in Denver as well. And he and I eventually got to meet up at an Enterprise Data World and have that discussion. And I looked at his book. It's like, oh, yeah, I like that. You called it this. It's like, that's, I've been thinking we needed something. I just didn't know what to call it. And he came up with some good terminology. You had a slightly different kind of team. You know, we discovered that an expert scrum master who had led Java teams was not the right person to lead a data team, because their way of thinking just didn't work. The flow of what you needed to do in a data project turned out to be fairly different than in developing a web page or a web-based app. It was very, very different. But we eventually figured it out how to do it and how to do things in iterations and try to do a horizontal slice from source all the way to delivery, right? How can we get that down to a short enough iteration to deliver value in a reasonable amount of time? And at the time when I first started talking about this, data warehousing projects were notorious for, you know, taking a year and a half, 2 years, and, you know, maybe it was success, maybe not. And so I used to tell people, it's like the Agile manifesto and the Agile principles talk about delivering in a short period of time. 2 weeks is like an ideal, but people were starting to say, well, if you're not doing 2 week iterations, you're not agile. It's like, well, no.
Right.
Like, for a data warehousing project, if we could deliver something in 3 months, we'd be agile, right? If we had something valuable, if we had valuable analytics in 3 months, in 90 days, if we could deliver something to the business users in 90 days, that's a major win over every other data warehousing project in the world that's taking a year and a half, 2 years, and they scratch their heads when they get it and go, yeah, that's not really what we needed. The team at Denver Public Schools, we got to the point, we were delivering changes to production every week by the time I left.
Jeez.
We put together I looked at the theory of constraints and the goal, if you're familiar with that book.
That's a great book.
Yeah, and pulled some of that out and said, okay, my job as the team lead is to figure out where the bottlenecks are in the process and do the downstream blocking, make, you know, get everything out of everybody's way. And we had, I mean, we had morning standups. We did morning standups every day. We couldn't keep them. They went a little long sometimes, but everybody had stuff to do every day. And every day we reviewed what they did the day before. Never got too far afield where I didn't find out about a problem where somebody had been distracted. Somebody pulled one of my team members off to do something else. And then I went and, you know, raised a ruckus with my bosses and said, hey, knock that off. If you want us to deliver this stuff, you can't take my team without telling me. So I learned to do all of that sort of thing. And we, like I said, we got to the point that what did they call them? It was the technology review committee. You know, you had to run things through them to move things into production. And they met every Monday. And it got to the point I was there every Monday with five or six changes to be put through on the data warehouse. And we did, we had dev, QA, and production. And we had checklists. We had actual physical checklists that I made people go through. And we'd sit down in a team meeting and review the checklist and make sure everything had been in, all the I's were dotted, T's were crossed before we ever pushed a button to move something. And we never in, I guess it was probably 3 years once we got this all going, we never had a failure in our move to production. And the only failure we ever had in the data warehouse was one night we ran out of space because the DBA had not been paying close enough attention to the disk space. The ETL process ran and filled up the disk space and Oracle stopped because we just got errors because there was no more disk. And once they added the disk to the database, then it ran. And that happened, I think, twice in 3 years. And that was the only time we had a process failure. And that was, you know, it was a drill down off the Agile Manifesto. And I just started looking at that. And so we'll tie this back to my education, right? Yeah, degree in environmental science. But part of that also, I took philosophy and sociology and intro to business management. And so I took a lot of stuff. It wasn't just science. And the learning the Socratic method in Greek moral philosophy and reading Socrates and Plato and, you know, a bunch of all the other, I'll say, classic philosophical works taught me how to ask questions and how to try to think about things objectively. And, they taught what we refer to as, critical thinking. Right. So I didn't take things at face value when people said, oh, you can't apply this to data. I'm like, well, why? Why not? And so looking at the principles, I was like, let's look at the core principles here. And then reading things like the goal, Oracle DBA at a conference had recommended to a bunch in her whole audience that we read this book. And so looking at that, looking at theory of constraints, putting that all together, it's like, well, what can we do? Can we craft a solution here? I want to make my team like an assembly line in a factory that we get a problem. We figure out what we need. You know, we're going to add data to the data warehouse. How do we do that efficiently? How do we expand the data model without going crazy? Add the ETL. I mean, we did things like things that would have broke other people, adding a single column to a report in a day. That was unheard of. That was absolutely unheard of.
It was still unheard of.
Well,
in a lot of
places. That's,
I mean, then you describe it. I think you might have been one of the first practitioners of quote data ops.
Well, yes, you're right. That's probably why when I started talking with Justin and Guy at DataOps.live when I was working at Snowflake, and we started talking about they said, what do Snowflake customers need? You know, with this new stuff in the cloud, and everybody's asking about CI/CD. Guy Adams, who's one of the co-founders of DataOps.live, had a background in DevOps, right? And so that all kind of came together. It's like, well, how can we do this? Because I was always thinking about, because of my background in software development, how do we optimize the flow? How do we optimize the delivery in the data world? Which, somebody else came up with DataOps and did the DataOps Manifesto. Based on what I had done with the 12 principles of Agile, that's where Justin and Guy and I we came up with the seven pillars of true data ops, which, you know, the thing we talk about on my podcast. That's where that concept came from. Is like, you know, you got the data ops manifesto, but nobody else had ever written a lot else about what do we really mean by data ops. So it's like, oh, let's go down one more level. Let's get something a little more specific. And that was based on my experience here at Denver Public Schools there in the early 2000s.
It's crazy.
But yeah, I hadn't thought about that. I guess I was probably.
No, what you just described, the fact you even read the goal in the first place, I'm just like that. I've read the goal. I come from a lean background, manufacturing and so forth. So it's like that's like pretty much the Bible, or one of the Bibles, I would say. But it's interesting to hear a software or a data person talk about it, because that's a weird book to recommend.
And that was an Oracle recommended that at one of the Oracle conferences.
It makes a ton of sense, though, right? In our type of work, it's like, what do you deal with? Bottlenecks. You deal with like lots of batch, lots of rework, that kind of stuff. Exactly what they talk about in the goal. So for the audience, the goal is a book about basically a disaster of a manufacturing plant that's given, 90 days?
Or they're going to close
it
down.
Around, or they're going to be closed. Yeah. And this guy randomly meets this like sage old man somewhere, I don't know, panhandling or something. And then he ends up like being wise and saving this company through the theory of constraints and showing him how to see things.
And then you have, what is it? The Phoenix Project.
Project.
Which is basically the application of theory of constraints and the goal in a software development world. And that's kind of became the kind of guiding light for DevOps. Right.
Yep.
And what people could do with DevOps, and they're saying, hey, you know, Netflix, Amazon, they turn out X number of iterations in like 24 hours. Right. They've completely mechanized it. And that, you know, that was for me, you know, that became inspiration. It's like, you know, we ought to be able to do this with data, but I hadn't thought about it till you said it. I guess. Yeah. My team there, Denver Public Schools, we definitely did it.
Well, and definitely the most unlikely place for data ops may have started was those Denver Public School System. So it's
And you'll love this too. We ended up with, at the time, Oracle had this tool called Oracle Warehouse Builder, and it was their code generator for PL SQL for doing ETL. It was a GUI interface, but it generated PL SQL code and workflow code in the Oracle database. So it was definitely, you know, what we talk about, run everything near the data. So we were doing that in the early 2000s, but we actually built what turned out to be the largest repository in Oracle Warehouse Builder, to the point that I got to be friends with the product manager at Oracle because we broke one of his upgrades. Because we had over 3,000 mappings, and this was for Denver Public Schools, to build out this persistent staging area, which was basically an ODS, a data vault, and then dimensional models on top of that. And we had it all, you know, we modularized it. Basically, I learned that in early, you know, writing Fortran code. It's like, do things in small modules, reusable modules. And so we did that even using Oracle Warehouse Builder. And it got to the point that we actually had the product manager flew to Denver from the Bay Area to look at what we were doing, and sat down because he couldn't hardly believe what I was telling him, the problems we were having. He'd come in and the first day, within an hour, he's like, well, oh yeah, we can do that. And you go, oh crap. Well, let me try this. Oh crap. And like within an hour, he found 10 bugs in his own product.
No,
because we were really, and this is something I take a lot of pride in. I did this with Oracle Case as well. I learned this from the guy who taught me Oracle Case. We really exercised the product. We looked at what should this product be able to do, and just, you know, some extrapolations based on what we were told it could do. Let's see if we can get it to do this. And it really should have been able to do many of those things, but they didn't have a good enough, get this, regression test suite. And so they eventually imported, we got permission to give them an extract of our repository. And so they imported that and used that to develop their regression tests for all the other upgrades after that. But yeah, no, the fact that happened at Denver Public Schools, right? It's not what you wouldn't expect that, but then, you know, I built a good team. I actually ultimately ended up hiring in to work for Denver Public Schools a number of consultants that I had worked with at at, you know, with when I worked for Lynn, I worked for Aris Corporation. And so a bunch of the Oracle data gurus that I had worked with in the Denver area over the years, I convinced a number of them to come work for Denver Public Schools and work on this team. And so we had a very high functioning team that were really experts in their craft. And that allowed us to push the envelope quite a bit and develop all these things. We had automated notifications after every ETL run every night that told us where things didn't quite work right. We actually, and I did, this was like, I'm sure you've heard, had this argument with DBAs. I enabled constraints in my data warehouse. I had foreign key and primary key constraints enabled, but we learned a technique. We came up with this idea. We disable them, run the ETL jobs, and then re-enable them. And we were able to capture the failure. So anywhere a foreign key constraint failed, we were able to capture that and produce a report, which that was our first data quality feedback loop, is then we could go look at the data and go, well, why did that constraint not re-enable? And it's, you know, we could go do the comparisons in the data sets and figure out, oh, well, you know, this source didn't send us the data last night, or there's bad data in the source and these things don't line up. And we were doing that via email again in 2003 and four. I had a really good Oracle DBA who knew PLSQL, knew a lot of these libraries that were buried in, that were delivered with the Oracle software in the database that nobody else seemed to really know about. And we were able to automate all of that. That's insane.
Yeah, this is actually interesting. I was going to ask you about Snowflake, but I actually find this way more interesting. The more you dive into it, the more I'm like, Ken Graziano is an OG and some cool stuff. I mean, you talk about notifications, data quality tests, all this stuff. I mean, this wasn't, I mean, I was getting my start back in the early 2000s in data, and I felt like these weren't the discussions people were having back then.
Yeah.
This wasn't a
no,
thing.
No. Like I said, I had people coming unglued telling me I couldn't apply Agile. And it's like, well, them's fighting words for me. You mean I can't apply Agile to data?
Like they were like that viscerally like upset about this.
I was getting, we were back then it was, we used list servers, mail list servers. Those were our discussion forums. I was getting the literal, you know, flame wars where somebody would like completely come unglued on me and flame it. Had there been social media at the time, I would have been getting sliced and diced.
Oh yeah.
Sure. But one of the things goes back to even my government work in the 80s is I learned TQM, Total Quality Management. I got taught when I was working, doing consulting at US West. They actually put us through CMM training. So I learned about the CMM levels. And then, of course, Dan incorporated a lot of that into the Data Vault methodology because he built Data Vault at Lockheed Martin in the 90s using DoD standards.
Right.
So he was an expert on Six Sigma, TQM, CMM, all of that. And so I was able to, a lot of those principles went into my understanding as I looked at Agile. It's like, okay, I could see some comparisons. One of the big things that allowed me to change the argument in Agile data warehousing is this conversation on customers and delivering valuable software to your customers. I started asking the question, well, who's your customer? Because in TQM, they taught us you have internal and external customers. So I started training people that for the data modeler's customers were the business people who are going to read the model and validate it. But it was also the ETL developer and the DBA who needed that for information on how they're going to build the database and build the code. And likewise for the ETL developer who is delivering valuable software. Well, that valuable software is really for the report analyst, because if they don't get the ETL code going, there's no data. And it doesn't matter how much the report developer knows. They can't really do anything if there's no data in the tables, right? And so I got people thinking about internal and external customers and thinking about other members of their team being their customers. That if I don't do my job well and right, then other people on my team can't do theirs. And once we got that in line and we put, like I said, put those checklists in place, then we were able to get that flow to really be a production line, that we were cranking out 5 to 10 changes of the data warehouse every single week. We put in 1 year, we kept track of it, and we had, in the space of 1 year, had like 375 change requests that we successfully executed on the production database. It's like, so more days than there are in a year. So we basically had, you know, 1 point something changes per day on average.
That's insane. Yeah.
And that was, like I said, and I left there in, was it 2006 is when I moved to Texas and took the job with HP. And that, you know, team kept running, and you know, the system's still running. They actually they migrated it eventually from Oracle to SQL Server, because the school district decided to change horses, but they were able to migrate the whole thing over. Some of that stuff's still running. There was something else that I did. Oh yeah, yeah. The data warehouse I did for McKesson, which was done using a data vault approach as well. Again, pre Snowflake, one of my gigs right before Snowflake. I just had somebody last week tell me that that system was still running. And I did that in like 2013 and 14. So that's been running for a decade. And it's a big data warehouse for clinical data for the U.S. Oncology Network.
Jeez. Yeah. Well, this wasn't the conversation I expected to have. So I think it's way cooler, though. I don't know. Have you told these stories before?
Over the years, probably not all in one sitting like this.
On one sitting. That's crazy.
But yeah. No, it's I've had a lot of fun, for sure. And of course, all of it, you know, we'll throw Snowflake in, you know, all of it led to, you know, being the evangelist at Snowflake. And that's, I think, one of the reasons I was able to be successful at Snowflake as the technical evangelist, is because I had all these experiences. So as we're moving people to the cloud, trying to convince people to move to Snowflake, you know, I could juxtapose, you know, some of the challenges I had in all of these things with the problems that Snowflake solved, with the separation of compute from storage, zero copy clone, time travel built in, all of these awesome features that Snowflake, you know, built. You know, I could go out and talk to a crowd at an Oracle user group meeting about the benefits of Snowflake and say, you know, this was my experience. You know, here's where the challenges were I had using Oracle to build these things. Here's how it's solved over here. So I had all that experience, and that really, I think, it helped. The experience at HP, learning about MPP systems, which I really didn't know about. So, you know, and Snowflake was obviously just competing with Teradata and the likes of that. And so I got all of that knowledge led to, you know, what I was able to do at Snowflake. You said I had a non-linear career, and I actually wrote a blog post probably 10 years ago about my career being like surfing. You know, surfing wave, just following the wave and looking for where, you know, making the turn when you need to make the turn so you don't wipe out, you know, not getting crushed by the wave, staying at just ahead of the wave, but being able to sort of ride that wave. And it's, you know, other analogies people would use is, you know, when a door closes, a window opens, right? And just being aware of that. And, you know, that's, you know, my advice to everybody is like, you know, keep your eyes on the market, keep your eyes on what's going on. You know, today it's AI, you know, 2015, it was Snowflake, it was the cloud. And it was like, okay, I'd been riding the Oracle train for nearly 30 years at that point. And, you know, being helping user groups, doing presentations all over the world and writing books on it, and looked at what Snowflake had and said, just like I saw with data warehousing, it's like data warehousing. Yeah. I'm shifting lanes. I'm going to shift from operational and scientific programming over to data and data management and BI. Looking at Snowflake is like, yeah, if this is it, this is the next big shift. And now today, of course, we're looking at AI, right? And Gen AI is another, you know, monumental change in the industry.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, you got to stay ahead of it. right? If you're going to stay relevant. But part of that is, you know, just having the open mind, the ability to ask questions and not take everything, like I said, don't take everything at face value. I would have been very disappointed if people didn't challenge me when I went to Snowflake. It's like, and ask about the technology and are you sure that really is going to work? And how do you know this is a benefit? That was good to see people doing that. And you know, same thing with AI now, you know, a lot of very valid questions out there about AI and Gen AI. I'm actually going to be going to the Data Universe conference New York in 2 weeks. I'm going to be doing a fireside chat with Eric Cavanaugh. We're going to talk about privacy and governance.
That's going to be a great one. Eric's a good dude. I was supposed to go speak at that, but then I had some family stuff come up, so I couldn't make it.
I wasn't planning to go, but then Eric called and said, hey, you know, we really want you to come be at this event.
Yeah,
so, that's awesome. Yeah, so I'm going to go. A DM radio thing with him tomorrow. Profiles and data. His first one with him yesterday. He put it up on YouTube last night. Eric's a good guy. He's been on my podcast, on the True Data Ops podcast, and he and I have, you know, like everybody in the industry, we've bounced into each other various places and venues for a couple of decades now.
That's super cool. Well, thanks for your time, Kent. This is definitely one of my favorite chats in the sense where I just got a good history lesson. Hope the audience did too. And from a real world practitioner, I think, you know, you've definitely covered, I think, a lot of your experience at Snowflake, and that's been very remarkable. But I think it's good sort of peeling back the career and understanding sort of what got you to today. Because I had no idea. Like, I actually have a note here. I called you the data in parentheses ops warrior.
I guess so.
I was just like, whoa. I mean, yeah, I was like, this dude's legit.
And I think, you know, all of that experience with Denver Public Schools, up through them and working with McKesson and all the others, that agile experience and that data ops experience carried over very well into Snowflake, because Snowflake, some of those features, like it's a, you know, zero copy clone. It's like, that's a total data ops thing, right? One of my very early blog posts there was actually how to do agile DevOps on Snowflake using zero copy clone before the data ops world word even really came out. It's like, I worked this out with Steve Herskovitz, who was the head of sales engineering on, you know, how do we think about this? How are we going to build, you know, take advantage of this really cool feature that doesn't require extra disk space to get people to build a dev, a QA, and a production instance? And how do you move this? Okay, great. It's very obvious. We're going to clone the production and call it dev. Great. Now, how do we go about making changes to that and moving it up? And so we worked out a process for doing that manually. That made sense to people. And that was kind of the beginning of it. So I was able to go and apply all this agile thinking, I guess, to Snowflake, and in ways that I think some of the Snowflake people hadn't even thought of. Right.
Right.
You know, so, yeah, great. We can spin things up instantly. Right. And run things really, really fast. But what does that mean? And I immediately go, wow, this means we could actually have 1 week iterations. We could get very agile with making changes to a multi-terabyte, eventually petabyte size data platform because of this innovative architecture in Snowflake and all the features that came with it. You know, now what they call the data cloud is there's things we can do now that, you know, were really, really hard to do 10 and 20 years ago. Yeah, even 10 years ago before Snowflake. So it was a good experience. And as I say, I think the, going to Snowflake and getting to basically apply all of that knowledge and work with customers around the world to, you know, get them to think about things differently. Cause some of them are still, like you said, you don't hear enough about people talking about, you know, actually doing data modeling or trying to take an agile approach or being effective in their agile approach to data. Even today, it hasn't translated all that well, and just didn't get adopted, you know, and we're still working on that, you know, and I think, you know, the data ops movement, the true data ops movement, it is all about agile, you know, and
Yep.
And continuous CI/CD, continuous delivery. It's really, you know, how do we do that? Because, you know, we're moving at the speed of data now, which is the speed of light.
Yeah.
Really, you know, things are changing constantly. And if you don't adopt some sort of a agile approach, you know, whether you call it DevOps or data ops or whatever, you're not going to be able to keep up, right? You're not going to be able to keep up and take full advantage of the data that's at your fingertips.
Absolutely. Well, cool. Well, thanks for your time. For people who want to learn more about you or get a hold of you if they wanted to, or if you wanted to talk to people, where do you
best way is probably LinkedIn. Yeah.
LinkedIn?
Yeah, I do. Okay. I do have a website, kentgraziano.com. That's the Data Warrior site. Since I've kind of gone into semi-retirement, I don't post on it a lot, but you know, some of the things I've referred to, there's definitely the archives are all still there with, you know, all the various posts I've done over the years on Snowflake and on Agile and Data Vault. You know, links are there to my Data Vault books are all there. So that's a good place to start, but you know, see what's happening any given day, you know, LinkedIn and Twitter. X, as it's called now.
X, yeah.
I still am out there a little bit. And so with the various companies that I'm advising and other webinars and podcasts and things that I do, you know, those certainly all get posted out there.
Cool. Awesome. Well, great chat. Love talking to you all the time. And like I said, this is a good conversation.
Thanks, sure thing. Thank you, Joe.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah. Let me just...